One, just thinking about recording. And we're good. This is Roger Zackheim coming from the Reagan Institute in Washington, D.C., the D.C. office of the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute. Welcome you to Reaganism, and our guest today is Congresswoman Liz Cheney. Thank you so much for joining the show.
Great to be with you, as always, and always love to participate in any of the terrific events the Reagan Institute hosts. So thanks for having me, Roger.
Well, we appreciate that. And, you know, no good deed goes unpunished from participating in the Reagan National Defense Forum. Now we have you on the podcast, so we greatly, greatly appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Lot to cover today. So much is going on here in Washington, D.C. and across the country. But just for our listeners, many people know you because you are the lone congresswoman from the state of Wyoming, of course, the daughter of a vice president. But your life and going in and out of Washington certainly dates back further than when your father became vice president. Of course, he was a chief of staff during the Ford administration, and then, like you, served in the Congress. What has that been like, kind of a lifetime almost, of coming in and out of Washington with public office, either you're in public office or a family member, and then going back to life outside the Beltway?
Well, I feel like it's really, it's been an incredibly blessed way to grow up and to have had the opportunity to sort of see both worlds. But certainly many of my earliest memories have to do with my mom and dad and their public service. You know, when my dad was chief of staff for President Ford back in the early 70s, and my sister and I were young, and he would take us down to the White House on Saturday mornings to have breakfast with him. And because as you can imagine, his schedule was very busy. And we would sit on the floor of his office in the West Wing, which is still the chief of staff's office today. At that time, the very high tech nature of the tools that the chief of staff had at the ready involved multiple televisions. And I can remember Mary and I being so impressed that, you know, there was a wall that had like four televisions on it. So you could watch cartoons on every network simultaneously.
Beat the press and cartoons going on all at once?
I feel like we probably changed them all to cartoons. So, you know, that those were the days when you could only watch cartoons on Saturday mornings on networks. So
being a kid in Washington, you had the White House as a venue, and then after that, the Congress as a venue, right? Because then soon after your father left, after the Ford administration and during certainly the Reagan years, he was, like you, in the leadership in the Republican conference. Was that a fun place to be as well?
Yeah, I think that was really the first taste that I had. We campaigned across Wyoming as a family, and walking in parades and, you know, knocking on doors and handing out buttons and just really learning what it means to participate in the political process. It was really wonderful memories, especially that first campaign. And of course, in the middle of that first campaign, my dad had his first heart attack. And so there was a sort of a period of time there where we weren't sure whether he was going to continue to run. And my mom took over. We campaigned with her. But it was really just a wonderful way to get to understand how politics works in our country.
I never asked you that. So seeing your mom campaign, of course, as your father was recovering, that is well known. But seeing a woman in that role, was that kind of a moment where in your mind you were like, yeah, I'm going to do that?
You know, it's interesting. Mary and I both were just so blessed to grow up with parents for whom the issue of our gender never even occurred to me, I'm sure to Mary, that would be an obstacle to anything we wanted to do. It was just an issue that was not even discussed. You know, I remember growing up and my mother was writing and teaching, and one of the first things that I read was an article that she wrote about Elizabeth Blackwell, who was the first woman doctor in the United States. And so for us, it was just, you know, we knew that if we were willing to work hard enough, that we shouldn't be denied opportunity because of our gender. And so
it was almost a matter of course.
Yeah, exactly. It didn't even occur to, it certainly didn't occur to me that being a woman would be an obstacle. And I think we were just always expected to work hard and prove ourselves. And certainly grew up knowing how important it was to fight for what's right.
But you really did straddle in terms of the world of politics and policy to both. You had that exposure you just referenced from your years when your father was in the Congress and campaigning as a family in Wyoming. And then, you know, later on, of course, he becomes Secretary of Defense and then Vice President. And you served in the Bush 43 administration in the State Department. So how'd you go from kind of looking at things from a family of politics, then to working in the policy world of Foggy Bottom?
Well, I think, first of all, for us, the policy and the politics have always been completely intertwined. And again, I know, you know, when we would sit around the dinner table as kids, the discussions were usually about what was happening in the world then. And politics is a very important way to make sure that you can get the right policies in place and the right people elected to do that. So I've always seen those as really intertwined. I've also always been very interested in and focused on the Middle East, and something that I really became interested in for the first time when I was about 10 or 11 years old, reading about, you know, King Tut in history class. But then worked on that throughout the years, worked on it when I was in private practice, working on business deals in the Middle East, worked on it at the International Finance Corporation, and then when I went into the State Department. It was actually my second time into the State Department, though. The first time during the first Bush 41, working on aid programs to former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe right when the wall came down.
That's a fascinating period.
Poland and, yeah, Hungary and the Czech Republic were all opening up. So
I want to get back to that, but you were mentioning before that for you it was a matter of course that as a woman, should you pursue it and have the ambition, elective office, be it from Wyoming or anyplace else, was reachable and doable. Of course, now we are looking at an election here in a few months. One of the areas of focus in your role as chair of the Republican Conference and in the House leadership is thinking about getting Republicans elected come November in the House of Representatives. And particularly, one area of focus has been getting women elected. Your colleague, Elise Stefanik, has been highly focused on it. And then of the, I believe, the 197 Republicans, maybe just a little more than a dozen, maybe 13, are women. So the matter, of course, in your mind hasn't actually played out. Give me your perspective on, one, why that is the case, and two, your thoughts about changing that number.
Well, I think first of all, the number is way too low. We've got to do everything we can to get more women elected, more Republican women. Secondly, it's not an accident that the number is so low. I think it's important to remember that, you know, Speaker Pelosi was really effective at targeting our women, particularly if you look across California, you look at, you know, the kinds of tactics that the Democrats have put in place, things like ballot harvesting and others. That have really particularly helped to ensure, in some places, I think unfairly, that our women and our men candidates have been beaten.
Ballot harvesting, just for those who may not be as familiar with the nomenclature of elections and different things that take place to shape outcomes, what does that reference?
Yeah. Well, I mean, as an example, Young Kim, who's again running in California, Young Kim, we thought had been elected. She had more votes on election day. She won the election. But then as absentee ballots came in, and ballot harvesting really refers to a tactic that the Democrats have used extensively in California, where they have volunteers and sometimes not volunteers, sometimes people who are paid, who basically go around and collect absentee ballots, make sure that people that may not know that they could vote, even if they frankly are not here legally or if they're not really qualified to vote, help to get those people ballots and help to ensure that anybody who can get any kind of access to an absentee ballot votes, and then they harvest those ballots, they go and collect them basically. We believe that you should only be able to vote if you actually legally are qualified to vote. We think one thing that's really important is we gotta clean up voter rolls so that people who are able to vote, who do have the vote, who are legally qualified, don't have their vote diluted by people who shouldn't be voting and who are frankly abusing the system.
So are you optimistic that the number of elected women in the Republican House will increase this election cycle?
I am. We've got just a tremendous number of very well-qualified candidates across the board. And I also think, you know, I think it's important that we not just elect women, because of course there are some women like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib. We need fewer of those kinds of members of Congress. I think they have a set of views that are dangerous. But I think that we need to encourage women to jump in. We need to encourage people who may be sort of sitting back thinking they don't have the experience or the expertise to go ahead and take the leap and to recognize how important it is to have their voice at the table.
You know, another just thinking about Republicans, electoral prospects, and some of the challenges is young people. President Trump, I think, trailed his opponent in the demographic between 18 and 29-year-old by 30 points in 2016. What are your thoughts about getting that group of Americans, the 18 to 29-year-olds, to support and vote Republicans and share kind of the outlook of a Liz Cheney?
You know, I think that a lot of it has to do with the kinds of things that, frankly, Ronald Reagan spoke about and stood for. And the idea of you know, what we need to make sure that everybody in this society can prosper is we need freedom, we need equality of opportunity, we need people to recognize and understand that the fight against socialism is a fight that goes fundamentally to whether or not we can exercise the individual rights that our Constitution guarantees. And I think Reagan, Thatcher too, were so important, obviously historically, but so important at laying out the terms of that debate and at explaining to people what happens when nations adopt socialism. I think unfortunately today, too many young people are attracted to the idea of socialism. Too many young people, I think, view that as somehow a more equitable way to organize society, when in fact, what it does is it steals power from every single individual and gives it to the federal government. And I think we need to really do a better job at making those kinds of points so that young people understand that their future, their ability to affect the future, their ability to make decisions for themselves and their families ultimately requires that we protect freedom. And protecting freedom can't be done if you're trying to expand government control and impose socialism.
I want to drill down on that point for a second, because one of the things that is not well known and is perhaps not intuitive is President Reagan's support amongst those in that same demographic or discussing 18 to 29-year-olds. When he left office, that group supported him by some polls over like 90%.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And he was, you know, I think it's fair to say he was old by the time he left office, right? So we talk about why that was the case. I think part of it is what you just captured. What was he talking about? This idea of freedom in particular, having a kind of a substantive approach to talking about what's on the mind of a young person, also about their future, was also something that was a key component of what he spoke about. I mean, it was how President Reagan looked at individuals, but also spoke about the country, very much future-oriented. Do you think the Republicans that you see going out there running for office across the country, you have better insight than almost anybody, are focusing both about freedom? I mean, obviously you're highly involved in the discussions about China and democratic socialism, but also kind of how that ties to a young person's future.
Listen, I think we need to do more of it. I think that there's a tendency sometimes for candidates to think, oh, you know, people don't really care about foreign policy. They don't really care about national security. The Reagan Institute has done really important polling on these issues. And I just think that that's wrong. And I think it's dangerous for candidates to assume that. And I think that what, you know, our obligation is to ensure that people recognize we're facing a real choice right now. It is absolutely the case that when you look at the future of sort of the international global order, either the United States and the nations that defend freedom and believe fundamentally in freedom are going to determine what that looks like, or the Communist Party, the Chinese Communist Party, and the leaders of the Chinese government are going to make that determination. That is absolutely the battle that's underway right now. And I think young people, when they realize it, when they see what's happening, when they see the treatment of the Uyghurs, when they see what's happened in Hong Kong, when they see the extent to which doctors who spoke out about COVID have been disappeared, those are things we need to do more to make sure people understand fundamentally the difference here. This is not a moral equivalence. You know, this really is a situation where there is one power, which is totalitarian, which is communist, which absolutely will repress and oppress its people, will kill people who disagree with them, versus, the United States of America, which has always, though absolutely we are not perfect, and we're going through right now domestically the kinds of protests you're seeing on issues around race, but our belief and defense of freedom is unmatched and unparalleled around the world and in history. We have to make sure we
can. I want to go back in a moment. We'll really drill down into China and this competition, not just from a security standpoint, which you lead on and have tremendous depth on, but also as you were referencing the competition of political ideas. But you just hit on what's going on at home, and I want to kind of focus on that for a couple of minutes. We have protests around police brutality and racism in this country. Quick, just give me your take in terms of George Floyd and what it's triggered across the country, and how you, as a member of Congress, a leader in the Congress, is going to kind of take that and address it, if at all, in the U.S. Congress.
Yeah, well, look, first of all, the killing of George Floyd was horrific. And I think everyone who has seen that video recognizes that it was horrific. One of the signs that I've seen in the protests that I think is particularly moving is a sign that I've seen several protesters with that says, when George Floyd called out for his mother, he summoned all mothers. And I don't think that any of us who is a mother is unmoved by that. I think that we cannot live in a society where mothers of Black children have to worry that because of the color of their skin or their children's skin, that when they leave the house, they could find themselves killed by those who are supposed to be protecting us. I think that it's an issue we have to address and we have to deal with as a society. But I also think that it is absolutely wrong for us to say that we are going to somehow condemn all police officers. I think that the moves that you've seen in the last 48 hours to say that we're going to defund police, just ludicrous. And I think that, what we will see, what does worry me, is you will see good people decide they are not going to go into law enforcement. Good people say, I don't need to put my life on the line every day if this is going to be a situation where I don't have the resources I need, where I don't have the support I need, or where I'm going to be tarred by what has happened with people, like the officer who killed George Floyd.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, as a government, I think what we need to do is encourage, first of all, transparency. We need to make sure that we are dealing with recruiting issues. There's no way that somebody that had as many complaints against them as that officer did, both before he joined the force and after, should be on the force at all. And I think we need to do better.
Training people, which I believe he was doing too. I mean, that's, pardon me? Let alone training other officers.
Exactly. And I think that's another place where we need to make sure that we've got a much stronger mentoring program. So there's no question but that there are things that we can do and things that police forces around the country want help with and want support for. And I think that's important. But, when I see things like some of the graffiti, the attacks, I mean, I watched as your building was being broken into. I saw that, as it was happening on the live stream and the windows shattered, the graffiti that's been painted all over the mall and on the World War II Memorial, and the rioting and the looting that's gone on. I think that that does a real damage to obviously our neighborhoods and the communities, a number of them where you've got, you know, Black store owners and other minorities who store owners who have built those businesses. People's lives are on the line, and we have to be able to sit and listen to each other and talk about these issues. And we all have to come together to stand against that kind of rioting and taking advantage of what is a really important moment for the country.
Yeah. And you were just talking about police and law enforcement. As you referenced before, the Reagan Institute has done surveys, and we ask on the question of trusted institutions across the United States. And police and law enforcement do really well consistently year over year. That in our poll, Americans said really overwhelmingly 74% that they have great or some confidence in police and law enforcement. Do you see that degraded as a result of this? Do you think that number we will see go down, and trust and confidence in the police will lower to the point that we have a problem?
I hope not, certainly, Roger. And I think that a lot of this has to do with making sure that we're having this conversation in a way that reflects reality. You know, one of my colleagues, Pete Stauber, from Minnesota, served on the police force for over 20 years. And when you talk to Pete about what's going on in Minneapolis and across the country, you know, Pete says the police departments that are most effective are those that police with their communities, those that know the people in the communities, that work together, people who live in those communities and who are in any community and who are trying to raise their families want security. They want to know that the police are going to be there to protect them. They want to know that the stores aren't going to be looted. They want to know that, you know, if the retired police officer Dorn, who was trying to protect a store from looting and was killed in cold blood. I mean, I think those are the kinds of things that all of society needs to come together to stand against. And I think those are the police forces that are policing with those communities are the ones that are most effective. And those are the ones we also ought to have a way that we can more effectively share best practices around the country so that the police forces that are doing the right thing and that are working with their communities ought to be able to share their lessons across the
country. It's almost like, you know, the most important data is how local communities view their local law enforcement, police force, right? You know, poor analogy would be if you were graded by the way the country views the U.S. Congress, you wouldn't be reelected. however, if you were graded by how the those in Wyoming view you, you do remarkably well, and that's probably more important. You know, this is all going on, of course, amidst this pandemic, COVID-19. Right. And, you know, it's every city and locality and state is taking their own approach. When we think about the origins of COVID-19, you and others have really focused on China, and in particular, how the Chinese Communist Party conducted themselves in terms of transparency and making the world aware of what was going to come, and quite fatal, taking the lives of more than 100,000 Americans and scores more across the globe. Talk to us a little bit about your take on COVID-19 and another entry point discussing China as well.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, first of all, there's been this big debate about whether or not the Chinese Communist Party, the government of China, knowingly spread the virus. And in my view, that question has been answered. And as soon as you recognize the fact that they stopped travel from Wuhan into the rest of China, and they allowed travel from Wuhan into the rest of the world, they knew they had transmission from human to human. And they knew it, and that's why they stopped the travel into the rest of China. But the fact that at that time they allowed travel into the rest of the world, that's the only answer that you need. Now, we will be looking at, you know, continuing to look at, did it come from the lab? Did it come from the wet market? All of those questions are important. But in terms of culpability, we know the answer. They caused the virus to be spread around the globe, causing economic devastation. And, you know, 110,000 Americans at this point have been killed. So this is devastation at the hands of the Chinese.
That's almost enough. I mean, that mere conduct enough. Right. It really does. The rest of it could be, you know, interesting, but it doesn't right. change.
Exactly. And look, I think this is just speculation on my part, but I think that the Chinese government made a very clear calculation. I think they knew they had human to human transmission. They knew it was going to cause economic devastation. And they understood that if they did not allow it to transmit into the rest of the world, the devastation was only going to hit China. And I think that they made a calculation that they would rather be in a position, frankly, where that devastation was spread globally, so it was not only affecting China negatively. But it is absolutely a situation in which they are culpable. And it is only the latest example and the worst, obviously, the most damaging example of the nature of that regime and their inability and unwillingness to operate as part of the civilized community of nations.
So, you know, another facet which you are uniquely kind of qualified and have experience to address is the World Health Organization, an institution perhaps most Americans were not familiar with. You certainly are from your time in the Congress and also in the State Department. International organizations like the World Health Organization have to straddle countries that are competitors or even adversaries. But in this case, there's been a lot of criticism in terms of how the World Health Organization was complicit right. in terms of the Chinese, we'll call it narrative, with respect to COVID-19. President Trump, of course, has talked about and perhaps already implemented, it kind of is hard to pin down, defunding or not funding or something of that nature with respect to the World Health Organization. What's your take on the WHO and how, from a U.S. policy standpoint, we should or should not engage with multinational institutions like the WHO when they are complicit? If you take their view with the conduct of a Chinese Communist Party.
Yeah, I think that the WHO has hugely important work that you know we expect it to do, whether even before you get to the issues of COVID, when you're talking about issues related to Ebola, to HIV/AIDS, there are really important things that WHO was expected to do before the era of COVID. And the problem is, when you get into looking at what's happened with COVID, it's not just that they've been pushing the Chinese Communist Party storyline, but that storyline has prevented us from being able to stop the spread of the disease. And so when they were, you know, basically pushing out the talking points that you saw coming out of China with respect to, you don't have to worry about human to human transmission and it's contained and all of those things that the Chinese wanted people to think, but turns out wasn't true. I think, you know, that puts the WHO in a position where they're the organization that's supposed to be helping to save lives, but probably took action that cost lives. And I think that the United States has to hold these international organizations accountable. Mm-hmm. They can be very important. But I think that for too long, what's gone on, and you've seen this too, you know, anybody who's spent time working, for example, up at the United Nations, as I did when I was at the State Department, working with any of these international organizations, there can be and there tends to be very strong anti-American bias in a number of them, not to mention
the secretariat you're talking about, actually the professional workforce that supports almost the executive branch, as it were, for the United Nations.
Exactly. And of course, then you get into the, you know, thank goodness we pulled out of the Human Rights Commission at the UN. But, you know, the fact that you've got countries like, you know, Libya on the Human Rights Commission just tells you kind of what a farce these organizations have become. And they're getting, you know, tens of millions of taxpayer dollars every year. So I think that the president has done the right thing in terms of saying we aren't going to continue to provide that kind of financial support if these organizations aren't doing the job they were intended to do, if they've become just a forum to bash America, and if, as is the case with the WHO, they're probably causing lives rather than saving them. I think that it's important to have a WHO of some kind. It's important to track global pandemics so we can work together to defeat them. But when those organizations become as politicized as they have, and that's not an accident, the government of China is working very hard and very aggressively in many instances to seed those very same secretariat positions you mentioned with people who are supportive of and beholden to them. And I think it's dangerous.
It really comes down, is dangerous, and it really comes down to how do you hold these institutions accountable? How do you hold China accountable for their conduct? I mean, amidst COVID, you had China passing a national security law for Hong Kong, right? Yeah. Another example of where taking an international agreement between actually in this case, the United Kingdom and China with respect to Hong Kong, one country, two systems, allowing Hong Kong to remain independent and democratic, that's been walked back almost by every expert's account with this national security law amidst this COVID pandemic. What is the U.S. role? I mean, you're a big advocate of the U.S. Maintaining its leadership role in the world, and in particular, as you discussed earlier in this discussion, with respect to freedom and democracy. Give me your take on what's going on with Hong Kong, the national security law, and the U.S. role.
Yeah, well, look, I think this is it's a crucially important issue, and I think that the United States is uniquely positioned to be able to lead the nations of the free world. There really is no other country that can do that, no other country that will do that. And there, you know, if you look at books like The Jungle Grows Back by Bob Kagan, which came out a couple of years ago, where, you know, Kagan talks about, and I agree with him, that it is not an accident that for the last 75 years, we have lived through a time of unparalleled peace and prosperity and freedom. It is because the nation that was the most powerful on earth, had the strongest economy and the strongest military, was the United States of America, which was fundamentally based, founded on, believed in the values of the Enlightenment, the values of freedom. We are uniquely able to lead the world, and we should. We should because it's right, and we should because it's necessary for our continued security and freedom and prosperity. And that idea is being tested today in the United States. It's being tested in our political debates that are going on, and it's being tested globally. There, you know, the government of China would love for people to believe that democracy is just too messy. You know, that's sort of their line. It's just, it's too messy. It's too complicated. You really ought to, you know, throw your lot in with us, with China. We'll, you know, they're going around the world blackmailing countries, you know, to accept infrastructure, blackmailing countries over Huawei and 5G. Many countries now, because of COVID, are beginning to understand that that's a deal with the devil, beginning to understand the tremendous cost of entering into those arrangements with China. Certainly, government of China has even been blackmailing countries over medical supplies to help them respond to COVID.
That actually didn't work.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. I think we've seen positive moves now, for example, from the government of the UK, recognizing that if they do allow Huawei to play the role in their 5G that they have, you know, discussed, it's going to put at risk our intel sharing relationship with them. And I think COVID has just laid bare absolutely the true nature of that regime.
It's pretty amazing that a pandemic, COVID, has done more, I think, to shape public opinion, certainly the opinion of the United States, with respect to the real risks and challenges posed by China in a way that perhaps the Chinese building islands in the South China Sea to threaten countries in that part of the world simply has not. You know, we were talking about Hong Kong, and as you may recall, our survey showed that 68% of Americans support the pro-democracy movement, even if it angers China. And that was true prior.
Yeah.
Prior to COVID-19. It's probably that much support for, you know, human rights and in Hong Kong overseas. I'm going to just ask that question again. We'll cut out the ring.
Yeah, I don't know if I can. Can you see me the same way?
I can see you. You didn't change at all.
Okay.
So we'll just do that transition to the poll in 3 seconds here. We good, Keegs?
Yeah, I was just going to flag time for you.
Yeah, we got 10:43. We're going to do about 10 more minutes, and we'll do the lightning round. Is this going okay, by the way? We're good?
Yeah, we're good. I'm trying. I don't know why what happened with you on my screen, but
can you not see me?
I could see you, but you got really small.
It happens usually after a conversation with me.
Let's see. Okay. Well, I guess I'll just.
You're coming across very clear here. Okay. So you matter more than I do, and we're recording off my computer, so we're fine.
Yeah. So long as Roger's computer is good to go, we should be fine.
Okay.
All right, so I'll just jump back into the kind of Hong Kong nexus to U.S. views of promoting freedom. You know, one of the things that really stands out with respect to China and U.S. views of China and U.S. leadership in the world is that you recall the poll that we did at the end of last year where almost 70% of Americans, 68% of those polled, support the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong, even if it angers China. Of course, that's before COVID-19. Something that I think at times President Trump would be surprised to hear, and certainly those on the other side of the aisle from you also may not believe, or certainly don't think that's the role for America. But it seems overwhelming to me that Americans support standing by those with freedom. Maybe they don't support boots on the ground to do that, but certainly rhetorically and other things we can do on the economic front and the political front, there seems to be very strong support for.
Yeah, I think it is bipartisan, actually. I think that, you know, when you think about and you look at what America has stood for and why, standing with those who are fighting for freedom is really important. And I think, you know, it goes back to, again, Natan Sharansky famously talked about how much it meant, what a difference it made to him and his fellow political prisoners in the Gulag when Ronald Reagan spoke about them, when Ronald Reagan spoke about America standing up for prisoners of conscience. And I think that that's what America should be. And it's a tremendous strength for us. And so I think that, unfortunately, because we're in an election year right now, you do see the more partisanship around these issues connected to U.S. policy towards China than you otherwise would. But even before COVID, if you'd asked me what is an issue on which there is bipartisan agreement, I would have said taking a stronger policy position towards the government of China. I think that is something that you'll find. And now in the aftermath of COVID, I would bet if it weren't for Speaker Pelosi trying to sort of, you know, impose her way and not participate for partisan reasons in our China task force, you know, you'd find strong majorities in both parties know we have to hold China.
This, of course, is the task force in the Congress, in the House of Representatives, now made up of Republican members of Congress, looking at all aspects of the challenges posed by China. Did I get that right?
That's right. And it's chaired by Mike McCaul, who's the ranking member of the Foreign Affairs Committee. There are about 15 of us on the task force. We're looking at issues ranging from national security strategy, including sort of what we need to do at the Pentagon, what we need to do about economic warfare, cybersecurity, ideology, really looking across the board at the relationship with China and what the United States needs to do to ensure that we maintain our supremacy and to ensure that we protect ourselves as well.
I want to get back to the Pentagon and national security since you're such a strong leader on those subjects. But before we do, I just want to close out the discussion we had on Hong Kong, because I am no doubt if there's someone listening, perhaps who's very focused on what's going on in the country right now, the question will arise, are we really in a position, do we have any moral authority to stand with those in Hong Kong protesting for their own freedom and democracy when to many Americans on the streets protesting right now, they'll say, listen, we have our own challenges, right? We have our own difficulties, as you referenced before, with racism and police brutality. Do we even have a footing to stand on to talk to others, particularly the Chinese Communist Party, about their assault on freedom and democracy?
Well, I think certainly the Chinese Communist Party would like to draw an equivalence there. And I think that, you know, for example, they are members of the Chinese Communist Party, members of the government of China, who have been very active on Twitter. which I think is interesting and ironic, given that, you know, certainly nobody in their country could be active on Twitter if they wanted to. I don't even think can get access to Twitter for the most part. So
it only goes in one direction there.
Exactly.
Yeah, you can't tweet
right.
it.
That's right. So I think they would like to draw that parallel. Of course, it's completely wrong. Of course, the United States of America has, throughout its history, gone through periods of time where we have been able to come together, improve the country, improve fundamentally the extent to which our freedoms apply to everybody. When the Constitution was first adopted, of course, we had slavery in this country. Women couldn't participate. And we have made huge strides to help to perfect this republic, and we will continue to work on that. But we are a society based on freedom and based on the notion that you can publicly assemble, that you can criticize your government, that you can speak out. And I know the government of China would like people to think that there's some moral equivalence, but when they have been in the last several months killing doctors for speaking out, when they've been silencing political opponents for years, when you look at the death toll, you know, hundreds of millions killed throughout the reign of the Chinese Communist Party, there's just simply no comparison. So, you know, each time that I see any of the members of the government of China try to engage on Twitter and suggest that somehow, you know, they welcome open debate and discussion, you know, I always applaud those who send back to those members of the government names of individuals who've been disappeared to say, listen, let's start the discussion by talking to these doctors who simply, you know, no longer exist. You've probably killed them, but let's talk to some of the people that you've disappeared. It's one of the reasons why we passed legislation to rename the street in front of the Chinese embassy in Washington, D.C.
Right.
after Dr. Li Wenliang, who was the first to notify and warn the world about COVID.
It's marching towards a more perfect union, right? And that's fundamentally, we have a system that allows for that. We have a Bill of Rights that provides for that opportunity. And we celebrate when our citizens do that. And those are a set of points that the Chinese Communist Party can never make because it just, their system does not allow for it. And in fact, it prevents it.
I think too, Roger, it's important to say that, you know, the mere fact that they feel that they have to pretend that their system is like ours really tells you something about the weakness of their system. They cannot sell their system. They cannot let people actually choose, because nobody would choose communism. Nobody would choose the Chinese Communist Party if they actually had a fair vote. So they can't afford that, but they do know that that's fundamentally what people want and believe in, so they have to pretend that their system has that freedom, you know, even when it's very, very clumsy attempts that people know are simply propaganda.
Great point. And I could talk about this with you for more time than you have or you would want. I want to hit on one last point, which is a challenge you'll face, no doubt, in the next Congress, perhaps before, and then we'll get to our Reagan lightning round. What are you participating in that one? But you know, you mentioned the Pentagon. We've talked about COVID. One of the pieces of the COVID crisis has, of course, been the stimulus that the Congress has passed and the tremendous amount of spending, of course, the federal government has done to help manage the economic crisis, the economic component of COVID-19. That has led to many saying, okay, we have to get our house in order when it comes to spending, which is cyclical in Washington. And the last time we really went through this in a serious way was after the Great Recession and the need to get our spending together. That is inevitable, I think many people believe. Always the first on the list of things that will have to be cut, and where perhaps those on the right and on the left will agree, is our defense budget, our spending to support the Pentagon and the military. Do you anticipate that there will be defense cuts in our future, regardless of the outcome of the election?
Well, I certainly hope not, and will fight as hard as possible, and I know my colleagues will as well, to prevent that. As you know, Roger, we're already in a situation where The Joint Chiefs have said repeatedly, we've got to have 3-5% real growth annually in order to be able to carry out the missions in the National Defense Strategy. We're not there. We're flat this year, which when you factor in inflation is actually a reduction. Right. So that, and that's even before COVID and before the tremendous impact of COVID on the force in terms of having to cancel exercises and other things. So I think we're in a situation where we have to make sure that we don't see those kinds of cuts. And I think that, you know, as you pointed out, certainly because of the resources that we've had to appropriate for COVID, there is absolutely a necessity, and there was before that, to look at the debt. I think the debt is a national security crisis and challenge. We can't ever balance the budget on the back of the Defense Department, though. And I think that when you see things happening, frankly, like the announcement that we just had over the weekend, that the president might be ordering the withdrawal of forces out of Germany. Right. I think that's a huge mistake. And this is a moment where we need to be clear with our allies and clear for our adversaries that we are not going to abandon our allies, that we are not going to abandon the role that the United States has played in the world that has kept us safe and free. And in fact, the cost of abandoning that role in the world ultimately will be much higher. The cost of inaction, if you think about a world in which China sets the rules, or Iran or North Korea, the cost of us failing to act now will be almost immeasurable later. And so I think it's crucially important that we not go down that path.
Yeah, and you know, that almost gets to Bob Kagan's point that, you know, the 75-year period that we've enjoyed this freedom and this prosperity, which the freedom delivers, you know, came because we made those serious investments in guaranteeing the free flow of goods and the spread of freedom. You know, what's interesting is that I think most people would assume that it's good politics to bring to close bases, let's say in Germany, which reported the president plans to do. But President Obama advocated doing the same thing to rebuild at home. But we've seen in our polling that actually overwhelming number of Americans support. I mean, I think the number was 65% maintaining U.S. bases overseas because they believe and understand that those bases actually are the guarantor of freedom and prosperity and the commerce that delivers it. You know, from a political standpoint, is there an effective way to kind of capture that? Because of course, if they believe those bases are there to engage in armed conflict, right? And you have 100,000 boots on the ground fighting, let's say in Iraq and Afghanistan, all of a sudden politically, that's a big loser, right? How do you straddle that line when you talk to your constituents and other members of Congress?
Well, I really think that it comes down to the facts. You know, it comes down to when you're talking about what our forces in Afghanistan are needed to do there, we're talking about maintaining a presence that allows us to prevent terrorists from forming safe havens. And Americans would much rather be able to prevent the establishment of safe havens elsewhere, be able to fight terrorists elsewhere, than having to fight them here inside the United States. And I think that's a very basic fact about what's necessary in order to be able to continue our counterterrorism, our intelligence operations in the Middle East. Well, when you're talking about Europe, when you're talking about Korea, those are partnerships. Those are places where our forces have been stationed for years, not because we're at war in Europe, but because we know we have to deter, because we know the best way to prevent aggression, for example, by the Russians or in Asia by the Chinese, is to work with our allies to maintain the peace. I think that, you know, Jean Kirkpatrick and Ronald Reagan, the notion of peace through strength really means something. And weakness invites aggression. And I think that is a lesson that, you know, the Rand Pauls of the world never seem to recognize. It's a lesson that we seem to have to learn, you know, generation after generation to relearn it. But defending ourselves means that we have a military that is second to none, that we have the capacity and the will to take action if we are threatened, and that we will do that. And that is how you prevent people from taking action against us. That's how you ensure you don't actually have to go to war. because people know that if they attack us, if they threaten our interests, if they threaten our allies, we'll respond. And I think ultimately, as we start to, you know, see these moves to pull our forces home and to walk away from those alliances, you know, look, NATO is the single most effective alliance in the history of mankind, I would be willing to say. Certainly the single most effective military alliance. In terms of what NATO has managed to prevent, in terms of the freedom that NATO has managed to guarantee, and it's no wonder that Vladimir Putin would like to see NATO diminished. And I think it's really important that the United States of America not help him attain that objective.
We're going to jump to the lightning round. Great words by Congresswoman Cheney. Lightning round, just to remind you, is where we ask all our guests of the Reaganism podcast to share with us their favorite quote from President Reagan, or it could be when he was Governor Reagan or time in between he was in office. Favorite speech and or favorite book about the 40th president. So you could share with us either one, two, or all three. Over to you.
Well, there are so many to choose from, as you know, Roger. But my dad and I wrote a book several years ago called Exceptional: Why the World Needs a Powerful America. And the beginning of the book is a Ronald Reagan quote. I'm going to actually read it, because it's a really important quote. I want to make sure I get it exactly right.
But we welcome that here.
This is from March 23rd, 1983. President Reagan said, "It is up to us in our time to choose and choose wisely between the hard but necessary task of preserving peace and freedom and the temptation to ignore our duty and blindly hope for the best while the enemies of freedom grow stronger day by day." And I think that that quote really describes the duty and the obligation of the United States of America, you know, through all times, and particularly today. It's much easier to look the other way. It's much easier to say we aren't going to continue to stand up for freedom around the world. But if we do that, it will strengthen the enemies of freedom, and that puts our own security at risk.
We'll have to leave it there, Congresswoman Cheney. Thank you so much for joining the Reaganism podcast. We look forward to having you back on the show in the not too distant future.
Thanks, Roger. Always great to be with you.
All right. I'm going to stop the recording.